Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. After 18 months of waiting, we are here to discuss the second season of one of our favorite costume dramas, The Gilded Age.
New York, baby! New York!
Which is like 90% of the reason that we love this show. New Yorkers love to talk about themselves. It made its triumphant return to HBO and Max, which I'm still calling HBO Max.
Yes.
Whatever. It is what it is. We're excited to track all the drama between Team New Money.
Yeah.
And Team Old Money as they fight for power in New York's high society at the end of the 19th century. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul. And for those of you who are joining us for the very first time, where have you been? Come on. We're cousins who love to explore fantasy and sci-fi stories. Last year, we expanded our coverage to discuss our favorite period pieces also. We kicked off that coverage with discussing the Gilded Age, and so we're back to discuss Julian Fellowes' newest project with more in-depth analysis. You can find our episodes on Downton Abbey, Bridgerton, Outlander, and The Crown in your podcast feeds.
We're excited to spend each week catching up with the Russells, the Van Ryn clan, and all of the many rich characters, and I mean that in the both the literal and figurative ways.
Yes.
Some of these people real rich.
Real rich.
Real rich. And some of these people are just, you know, rich of a personality.
Yes.
This week, we'll be giving you a brief refresher on season one. I know I needed one. Mm-hmm. And a summary of this first episode and some of our analysis.
And as usual, I know you're excited about this adult content. Not probably nearly as excited as Oscar Van Ryn like pushing up on Gladys in the first episode. We'll discuss. And definitely not as excited as Justin Timberlake seeing Genuine in like the early aughts. Foshes, foshes, foshes.
I'm done.
But
Britney Jean Spears and Jada Pinkett Smith are bleeding into every part of my life. I'm just here minding my business, and now I have to mind their business too.
Yeah, 100%. It's a lot. It's a lot.
It's
oh,
too much.
Man. Who was that excited to meet Genuine? I'm just saying.
Hey.
All right. I know.
I love Genuine.
Pony. I know. It's good. It was good. It was a moment. All right. Well, let's get into it. Okay, let's talk about first season. When we last left off, Team New Money, Bertha and George Russell, the whole Russell clan, had finally broken through into New York society after being shunned for most of the season. They did this with the help of Aurora Fane, Ward McAllister, and the friendship between Gladys Russell and Carrie Astor. They are eventually accepted by Mrs. Astor, the gatekeeper, into their upper echelon of Manhattan society. Even their neighbor, Agnes Van Ryn, from the old New York, never forget that, dear, attends the coming out ball held at the Russell's only for the Russell's only daughter, Gladys. Marion Brooke, also moved in with her aunts after finding out that her father left no money when he died. Had her heart broken by the fortune hunter and notorious fuckboy, Mr. Rakes.
Named appropriately.
Named appropriately, Mr. Rakes. Oh, man. There's a lot of people who are exactly what their name says they are, which is funny. He used her to advance himself in New York society and then moved on to somebody else. Peggy Scott and her mother, Dorothy, discovered that Peggy's son from her annulled marriage did not die after being born, but was adopted. Peggy's father, Arthur, arranged all of this and refuses to help them find the boy. The downstairs staff, which we love, I love these folks.
I actually think they're like the best. They're the best.
I agree.
They're so good. They didn't get enough screen time last season, but I love that they're developing more this season.
100%. They're some of my favorite storylines. So, Monsieur Bourdain, the Russell's French chef, is actually from Kansas. Okay? He's not French at all. Bannister, the Van Ryn's butler, and Church, the Russell's butler, have unresolved beef. Beef in these streets between the butlers. Okay? where Mrs. Russell hires Bannister briefly to help her with a British-style luncheon. Unsatisfied with her position also, Mrs. Russell's lady's maid, Turner, tries to seduce Mr. Russell. She gets into bed with George, like, hey, you know, your wife...
It's so messy.
It's the worst.
It's so messy. It's so cringy. What was she thinking?
And then he doesn't tell her. Then he's like, yo, I'm not going to say nothing. I'm just going to be... So, I mean, he's trying to keep her, right? He's trying to keep her lady's maid on staff, but he handles it appropriately by kicking her out. She lets Oscar Van Ryan know, which is kind of wild, right? Like, it's kind of wild that she's, like, working in cahoots last season with Oscar for him to get with Gladys and her to get with George. But eventually, Mrs. Russell, for other reasons that have nothing to do with this whole thing, decides to fire Turner. And that's the relevant details from season one.
All right, let's get into episode one of season two. We pick up with our beloved characters on Easter 1883. The Van Ryans and the Russells attend the same church and meet the new rector, Luke Forte. Mm-hmm. Forte. Mm-hmm. We learn during this church service that Mr. Russell's having some issues with his steel workers in Pittsburgh as the labor movement is starting to gain some momentum. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. During the conversation with the new rector, Marion also learns that Mr. Rake's marriage will take place very soon. I don't care. I don't either.
I don't think she should. I don't think she should care.
She's better off. This guy sucks.
Yeah.
The Scots spend most of their Easter in a church in Philadelphia after learning that Peggy's son died of scarlet fever 6 months prior. They visit with his adoptive family and mourn their loss. Feeling lonely, Oscar tries to pick up a man in a bar and gets robbed and beaten instead. We have to talk more about this because this was very disappointing plot line.
Wild.
The Russells decide that having one enormous house on 61st Street that's like the size of a city block isn't enough.
Nah. Mm-hmm.
Not enough for all that stuff. Mrs. Russell loves to buy stuff online, and so she needs a much bigger house to hold all of her online purchases.
Maybe
that's just me projecting.
And also, you know, why not when you can just hire your son as an interior decorator and keep that money in the family? You know what I mean? Like, why not do it? It's super. But this house in Newport is phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It's crazy.
It's also massive. Like
huge.
It looks like a traditional British manor house. It's massive.
But then it reminded us, we were talking about this offline. It reminded us when Cora in Downton is like, they had a small, what they call a cottage in Newport. And we're like, is this a cottage in fucking Newport? Like, is this what we're talking about? Craziness.
Yeah. So gentle listeners, please bear with me. I had watched Downton Abbey many times before I caught on that when Cora's mother is talking about her cottage in Newport, she's talking about a mansion. I was like, oh, that's weird. A cottage in Newport? I had no idea that's what they called them.
Oh my God.
This is a cottage. This is it. Massive house. So Mrs. Russell has her new house that her son has renovated and redesigned, but she's still fuming because she's always big mad about something.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have not been invited to get a box at the prestigious Academy of Music for the opera season. She decides that she wants to learn more about this new opera company, the Met, which puts her at odds with her favorite frenemy, Mrs. Astor.
Well, Mrs. Astor is being kind of shitty. She's like, yeah, you can be in society, but you have to, you know, bow down and wait in line and get everybody else before you can get a box at the Academy. It's like, come on, man. Like, we already played this game, Mrs. Astor. You lost the first time. Why are you doing this?
You're not wrong. The Russells are such a complicated... I have a lot of feelings about the Russells.
Yeah, they are complicated.
They're like such a messy family. They're not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But then I remember all these people have more money than I can even imagine. So yeah. I'm like, cry me a river.
Yeah.
It's oh, hard man. To be mad. See, I told you Justin and Brittany just in all of my, just like, even in my vernacular.
Oh, my gosh.
Peggy and Marianne meet, and Peggy wonders if she might be able to get her old job back as Mrs. Van Ryn's secretary. Mm-hmm. And it's revealed that Marianne also has a job. Mm-hmm. Hmm. She's been hiding this from her aunt. She is the watercolor teacher at a local school for girls.
But it's how it's found out. It's so wild. It's like super wild that it's found out because Dashiell Montgomery shows up and his daughter is like, oh, what are you doing here? Like, and then she has to like tell it. Oh my gosh.
It's
Agnes is hilarious.
Yes. Agnes has like a complete meltdown about this. Like, it's, you would think that she like murdered someone. Like, it is like such high drama over the fact that she has a job.
Oh, it,
giving
man.
Us very much what's a weekend vibes from yes, Agnes. Over
exactly.
Here.
Oh, it's very good.
The Russells hold a dinner hoping to convince some of the wealthy families to take a box at the Met, but also maybe take a box at the Academy too. You guys got all the money in the world. Have boxes everywhere.
Why choose?
Yeah. Why are you going to limit yourself?
Yeah.
They invite the McNeils to come to their dinner, which complicates things because the mysterious Mr. Watson, who was running around like sneaking off on these walks, it turns out he is Mrs. McNeil's father. That's why he was stalking her last season.
Yeah.
The dinner ends with a performance by Christina Nilsson, one of the most noted opera singers of the time. And, you know, the Russells just being really extra. They like create a theater in their house. Like, it's just really,
yeah,
really extra. It was cool, but it was extra.
Bertha is like, she's growing though in this sense, is that she didn't even tell Mrs. Astor who was going to be on the guest list. She gave none of the information so that it was like all like a surprise to kind of like ambush her a little bit. And she was about to roll up out of there. Like, Mrs. Astor was like, yo, you all right, you got me, but I'm leaving. And then leveraged the like front page of the paper, like as like, don't leave, cause it's going to create a scene. Very good maneuvering to get this to like go down the way that it went down. Very, I was impressed. It's yeah.
She is constantly trying to outsmart the elite, and it works for her most of the time. I get worried that at some point her luck is gonna run out.
Yeah, I agree. I
like at some point her luck is just like not gonna be there because she handles Mrs. Astor beautifully.
Agreed. And at some point it's not gonna be Mrs. Astor probably that she has to deal with, right? Like some point maybe Mrs. Astor and somebody else, I'm thinking. Like, and you know, maybe that's beyond this season even. I'm hoping that this thing keeps going. But yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting how it's going. So what stood out to you?
Can we just talk about the opening credits?
Yeah, they were great.
They're so good. They're so beautiful. I loved it. This first episode is like really just built kind of building up to something like setting the stage for what the major conflict will be this season, which I think we have to assume is going to be this whole opera thing. And kind of closing a couple doors, letting us know Mr. Rakes, that situation is about to take care of itself. Mm-hmm. And also off screen doing this thing with Peggy and her son. I don't know if you want to talk about that now, but I'm a little frustrated by that.
Yeah. I mean, we had the same response. This is one of the rare moments where we've gotten to watch the show together in the same room. So we were talking about it while we were going. And I just, yeah, I feel like they gave us all of this information last season. It was so part of the drama. It feels like they just kind of ripped it away without, they resolved it obviously by the child being dead and introducing the parent that adopted and how the wife and the adopted mother and her son died by typhoid fever. But it just feels like man, why all that build up to not make that a main storyline? You know what I mean? Like, it felt weird.
Yeah, it seems like they had a plan and then for whatever reason decided it would be too hard to have Peggy have her own separate story, which I think we may have talked about when we recorded our first podcast on the show, which is just like, if Peggy and Marion are separated, do their stories work? And I don't like stuff like this. And maybe it's not a big deal. I don't feel like it overshadows the whole season. But I don't like stuff like this because you can see the writer's hands. Like, you understand why they're resolving this sort of off screen. I don't really appreciate that this trauma is happening to Peggy off screen, and then we're just dealing with the grief of it, and the fallout of it. But I understand as a writer, like, they had to pivot from this Peggy has a living child storyline.
I would have liked to have seen the moment that she found out, not arrived at the Easter service after the funeral. Like, we don't get to see the funeral. Mm-hmm. We don't get to see her finding out. We don't get to see any of that. We only get to see her at the service, like, you know, then at the gravestone and in the bedroom. And to me, you know, it does the work of, like, wrapping that storyline up. And ultimately where I think I support them kind of getting Peggy and her family to deal with what's going on back to New York. Like, that the story is about, yes, all of these, everything that's happened in this time period, but it's about, you know, like, New York in this time period, right? So, in, like, titans of industry, people coming up into society, it's about the 400, the workings of the 400, which was in New York, right? So I feel like it was cool to get, like, her back to the city. I just feel like they could have done it by giving us some of those other beats without rushing it, you know what I mean? So that was my feeling.
I agree.
I really also love, if we're talking about the Scotts, that they did not go with, you know, Gilded Age should help House of the Dragon. Like, they should help House of the Dragon.
Oh my goodness. The wigs. House of the Dragon needs to meet with the Bridgerton people and with the Gilded Age people, because the wigs are so much better.
I mean, it's obvious that the Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon folks gave and let them use their title sequence folks, because, like, they were like, yo, you guys don't got nothing to do for a little while. Go make this title sequence for the Gilded Age. So it's only right that the Gilded Age helped them with where they're struggling also, which is their wigs. Like, I think that needs to happen. This is my headcanon, but I firmly believe these things in my mind. So
yeah, I think especially Peggy's wig is really good.
Yeah.
Like, really good. It looks great.
Yeah, no, it's really good. Really, really cool. I mean, it wouldn't be the Gilded Age without Agnes. And we're going to get there. We're going to talk about some of Agnes's best quotables, her quotables, the things that become memes throughout the whole entire year, right? Little memes, you see it, it's hilarious. But I want to, like, let's talk about some of the new characters. There's some new characters that are being introduced, and one of them is Dashiell Montgomery, who has a relationship to Agnes. And the reason I brought up Agnes is because Ada is, like, talking about Mr. Van Rhines. And Agnes is like, oh, you were on a first name terms. Well, that's funny, because I wasn't, and I was his wife.
Yeah, so Dashiell was the nephew of Mr. Van Ryan, whose first name is eluding me at the moment, who moved away, and his wife passed away. And now he's moved back to the city with his 14-year-old daughter, Frances. Mm-hmm. Frances is real cute. I really like her.
Yeah,
Dashiell's cute, you know, and these Van Ryans got money. So immediately I clocked him. I was like, come on, Marion, let's make this happen.
Cousin also of Aurora. Aurora Fane. You know, okay.
Let's just take a beat here. Why is Aurora Fane still on this show? Why? I don't understand. Did she not serve her purpose last season?
to create fuckery is why she's on this show, okay? Like, I don't, like, she got a man murked himself over her missteps in society. Not totally, but she definitely was part of that whole equation, like playing these little games. Man lost his whole fortune. I mean, he was on his knees begging Mr. Russell because of this game they were playing. Done off, okay? Then she turns on the wife of this, of the guy who killed himself, because the wife is like upset. Let's just talk about that for a second. And then she kicks off episode one with like, I'm gonna throw a party for you to go ahead and propose to Gladys, Oscar. I'm gonna make that happen for you. What the fuck is up with Aurora, man?
I just don't even really understand why Aurora is on the... I mean, I guess she's on this show because Marianne needs someone who is younger than Agnes and Ada to kind of help her in society. But, like, there's just some... I don't get it. Her character has no... Like, she doesn't have... What do we know about Aurora? What would you say to describe her? What kind of words would you use to describe Aurora as a person?
Messy. I would say, like, what I mean by that is she always finds herself in the middle of something, but she's never quite at the front or forefront of something. Like, she's in the middle of this little opera drama, but she's not picked a side yet. She's kind of vacillating between Mrs. Astor.
No, and she picked a side. She tells Mrs. Russell, I'm not going to the Met. I'm not going to go behind Mrs. Astor. Like, she's picked a side.
Yeah, she's definitely sometimey. Like, that's what I'm talking about. I can't even figure out which side she's on because she has no... She's, like, wiggling all the time. And, like, that's what got her in trouble in season one. Like, she was kind of, like, trying to play both sides. That she was helpful to Mrs. Russell to get her into society, but she also was hurting other people while she was doing it. So I just feel like I feel like anytime she's involved, there's going to be some drama.
I wish she would have clapped back against Mrs. Russell as well, because when she was like, we won't fall out over it, I would have been like, bitch, what?
Yo, she hit her with the, don't worry, we won't fall out over it. Yeah, worry.
And what happens if we fall out? Like, yeah. You're lucky I came to your little dinner.
Look, she knows that she only got her fortune because Mr. Russell was merciful. All right? Like, Mr. Russell was hurting them. Like, he was like, that guy was done off, and her husband is mad humble right now. He be in the room, he be around, but he don't be talking. He be head nodding, hey, nice to see you. Like, he has been humbled. He is good.
Aurora.
The Fanes.
Yeah, the Fanes. I don't know.
What did Mr. Fane do this whole episode?
He just, who is he? Pick him out of a lineup. Like, who is this guy? I know she's married, and I know that he must have been away because she brings Dashiell to the dinner.
Yeah.
But like, if he was there, I wouldn't know. Like, who even is he? I don't, anyway, I sound like Mrs. Van Ryan right now. Like, yeah, no. Who even is he?
So let's talk about Mrs. Van Ryan, AKA Agnes, who we are on first name basis with, I guess. Some of her one-liners, like, I mean the one that I love is, you may be getting older, but I'm not.
I laugh so hard when I watch that. I heard that because she is just like a force to be reckoned with. Like, she's just like, I will not be taken in a carriage to church. I'm gonna do what I've always done. Like, no one's gonna change me. I find her very amusing, and she's another character who's kind of complicated, right?
Yeah.
So she immediately embraces Peggy in season one as soon as Peggy comes on the scene, which, you know, back then you kind of just expected all white people to be racist. So, mm-hmm. You know, in that way, I admire that she was not only open to having Peggy as her secretary, but she treats Peggy with a lot of respect comparatively, right? Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, she loses her cool over this school teaching thing and says some of the meanest stuff to Marianne. And then when Marianne is mean in return, she's like not willing to let go. Even after Marianne's like, I'm sorry, I spoke too harshly.
Bannister will escort you across the street.
I just like... She knows you're sorry, and she's sorry too, right, Agnes? Bannister will escort you across the street.
It's funny, like, but it's cruel. Okay. Yeah, it's funny, but it's cruel for sure. It's like she's so stuck in all these like societal norms. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah, she totally overreacts to this because Marion is not some like debutante who has a huge dowry. It's totally normal for a girl who is in middle class standing, mm-hmm. or even upper class standing, but has no fortune to be a governess, mm-hmm. to, you know, do volunteer work, to work, like to work. Like that's not abnormal. She just flies off the handle like it's the end of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that she's just like, you know, she has a real hard time adjusting to this new world, this kind of burgeoning world of what's happening in this time period. Like she's very much, you know, like she makes reference to the freaking War for Independence. Like she lived through it. You know what I mean? Like it's like it's wild. Anyway.
Yeah, and in this way, her and Mrs. Russell are very similar, even though they don't agree on hardly anything else, because they both treat the young women under their care as if they can't do anything aside from under their careful eye. Mm-hmm. It's very, very frustrating to see throughout this season, like how many double standards there are. Mm-hmm. And the fact that like she loses it, that Marion is teaching at this school, which is a school for girls of the upper classes. It's not like she's like taking the ferry to Brooklyn every week and like teaching in some unknown school with unknown people. Like Mrs. Van Ryan's own great niece goes to this school.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's some unknown factor. It's just so the whole thing is really bizarre. But she's really funny in this hilarious episode. But she is, as you noted, she's also extremely cruel. And I think that that is just a mixed bag of Agnes. Like she is the kind of snappy character that we get that is supposed to be kind of like the Dowager Countess from mm-hmm. Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. But the difference is like, the cruelty wasn't there in the Dowager Countess. She could be petty and she could say mean things, but she also had a lot of empathy and compassion. And except for that one that one time when she lost it over Mr. Pamuk.
Oh my God.
she mostly treated, you know, the decisions that her granddaughters made as, well, I don't agree with it, but I have to accept it in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't blame her for not accepting the Mr. Pamuk thing because I still haven't accepted it. Well, it's still one of the funniest things to ever happen on any TV show that I've ever watched.
Pamuked out. He Pamuked out. It's over. It's over, Mr. Pamuk. It was so quick. Oh, man. Just quick enough for a Netflix trailer, and that was it. Oh, man. Yeah, I agree. And I think like this leads us kind of thinking about, well, what is all of this? This episode, for a lot of it, was set up. And mm-hmm. it was good setup. I really like the way they're setting things up. And I think, like, you know, we can already hear some things that are happening. One of them being, obviously, we've talked a lot about the Met versus the Academy. We'll talk more about that. But the labor movement. The labor movement was, you know, picking up steam in the 1880s. And so I think we're going to have a lot of the Knights of Labor coming up in this season is what I would say. And I think it's going to be interesting talking about the Russells being complicated, that, you know, you kind of root for them last season to get into society, but this introduces another wrinkle that they're uber wealthy. How are they going to handle the people who have helped them to become super wealthy?
Totally. I mean, I think that the way that Mr. Russell very casually is like dismissive of the concerns of the workers in this first episode is disturbing to say the least. Mm-hmm. But we've seen some of this before from the Russells because they I don't know. I don't feel like the Russells are like the best employers in terms of the downstairs staff either.
No.
I mean, they lost it when what was it, Monsieur Bourdin? Yeah. It came to light that he was actually not French. But
and she's still salty about that. She was like that, like when Aurora was like, "I hear you have the best French chef in the city." She goes, "That's more funny than you know." I'm like, "Why are you still salty? Just like say yeah and then keep it moving."
Yeah, I mean, the staff downstairs is still making fun of him about it. That's when I was like, "Oh, not that much time has passed," because the staff is still cracking jokes about it.
Yeah.
I do have to say, this is a total aside, I love the downstairs staff at the Russells. They're so nice. Like, mm-hmm. they're like the nicest. And now that Mrs. Turner is gone,
yeah.
they're just like the nicest, most supportive group of people. They're really sweet. So I
mean, it's hard not to feel like, you know, like freaking rainbows and sunshine when Armstrong is across the street. You know what I mean?
Can we take a moment though and acknowledge that Julian Fellowes clearly has something against ladies' maids?
We can.
I did not suffer through like 5 seasons of Mrs. O'Brien, Miss O'Brien,
yeah.
to have to deal with Turner and Armstrong.
I know.
Like, what? They're both awful. He clearly has a thing about ladies' maids. Like, why are they always the antagonists?
I have no idea. It's very true. It's very, very true. I that is a great catch. Oh my gosh. Ugh.
Can we talk a little bit about this fight between the Met and the Academy of Music?
Of course. That was the main thing. I
was, one of the funniest lines of this episode was when Mrs. Astor is like, "Wait, it's gonna run at a loss?"
Like most businesses? Yes,
right.
It is.
I was like, welcome to the 21st century where all new startups run at a loss, sometimes for a decade
exactly.
before they have to do anything. I'd like to introduce you to Uber and WeWork and all of those startups.
WeWork still struggling a bit out here in these streets, but that's who's counted? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I just thought it was funny. She was so shocked, like, that's not fair. And it was like, well, that's how business starts.
Yeah.
Like Mr. Russell was like, yeah, they don't expect to make a profit away.
I love it. They were like, what does that mean? And they were like, it means someone's got deep pockets to just keep like buying to make this happen. So that was I loved it. It feels this part of the story, because these are, you know, the Met is something we can like approximate in our mind today, right? Like, and while it's, you know, so it's interesting to like see this like battle, it makes the world feel even more lived in. It feels relatable. And you know, it's also like, you know, the Academy was exclusive and it was an exclusive place. We'll talk more about the Academy in a little bit, but they're freezing out a lot of even the wealthiest families, which is like, you know, it feels like stuff that happens today. Like, oh, okay, you're not going to let people in. It's too exclusive. Then you go in, somebody found something else and does something else. You know what I mean? And people all go there. So I think it's a age old tale that has a modern feel. So
yeah, there is something about having an exclusive brand, but you're limiting yourself
yeah.
because at some point you're going to run out of customers, because there's only so many people who are going to pay for your service or pay for, you know, season tickets, and you have to be able to survive in an era when there's other people who actually can afford your product, but you are saying, well, even though you can afford it, you're not good enough for it. It's absurd.
It's crazy.
It's absurd. It's like totally the most ridiculous business model I've ever heard of. Like, you have people who are clamoring to get in, and when they have an opportunity to get in, you're still saying, no, you have to wait. And you have to wait. It seems like the way they're setting this up is like, you have to wait just because we want you to wait, right? Like, the McNeils have been on the waiting list longer than the Russells. And there doesn't seem to be any decent reason for why they're on the waiting list, except for that Mrs. Astor decided they're not ready to let them in.
And they haven't built enough boxes to accommodate them. which is a
well, that's part of the problem, which, you know, Bertha Russell brings up, which is there's just not enough boxes, which is short-sighted and silly, as she notes, because she's much more business-minded than mm-hmm. I think most of the other women in the show. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, she, in that same conversation, she notes that there was a box that was available.
Yeah. No, agreed. And I think, and she's trying to say, oh, well, you have to wait your turn. But this is, you know, what's interesting about this is what Ward McAllister famously warned her about last season, when he was like, if you don't let some of the people who have this new money that is being developed through these new industries into our society and our club, then they'll just go and make their own. And it seems like what's happened here is like, the people who wanted to be part of appreciating music and bringing in and having these events were being frozen out of one of the only places that in the city at this point where this was like heralded by a certain echelon of society. And I think like, yeah, so they've just said, well, we're going to make our own. And that's, it's like almost like he called it and they still didn't adjust, even letting in this one family. They didn't adjust at scale to this reality that this was going to happen.
Yeah.
Which, we know who's not, whose brand is not the best at this point.
Oscar, I mean, Van there's Ryan. A lot of people, but
Oscar Van Ryn. You know, he crazy look. Some we're gonna pick apart Julian Fellows, but let's start with the stuff that we'll save that. Let's start with proposing. After not getting letters, so you set up a meeting through your cousin, you've been sending letters, she's not responding, and I'm not going to let Marion off the hook on this. She was like, well, if you really want this to happen, then you should, like, do it for real this time. Marion, just tell him no, this ain't a good idea. Why are you even promoting this nonsense? And then he goes for it.
Okay. This was wild, because when he said to Aurora, I just needed some alone time with her, I thought it was to like reestablish contact.
Yeah.
You know, just be like, hey, you haven't been responding to my letters. Could we like spend some time together? Maybe we'll do walks in the park or something. And she sits down and he's like, okay, so let me give you my proposal. I have a PowerPoint here. I got several points. You will have your own house. Freedom. I'm never gonna make you herald my opinions or echo my opinions. You will have a good life. And Gladys, who's what, like 18?
Yeah.
It's just that. Like, what? What is happening?
And then he tries to like leverage, like, but actually, let's even start before that. Easter Sunday, he was being super creepy and just like watching the conversation. So it was like, obviously he wasn't supposed to be talking to her. And then he breaks a societal faux pas that he knows. Maybe the audience is getting educated about this, but he already knows that he should be talking to her dad at this point. And so then he tries to leverage this patriarchal structure and saying, I'm more evolved. If you're with me, you won't have to follow all these rules that are set up, which is more than another man would offer. They would make you do that. So now he's like almost lightweight, not threatening, but it's a little menacing. Like, yo, I mean, if you don't pick me, you're going to pick some dude that's going to like make you have to do all the things he wants you to do.
I actually laughed at that part because she says, he was like, I would never make you echo my opinions. And she's like, of course. And he's like, no, other guys would make you do yeah. that.
I was like, what?
Yeah. Which is true. He's not wrong. Yeah. He's not wrong. But it was very it was a funny moment. I was like, oh, Gladys, sweetie, you're not. Your parents are abnormal. Like, your dad lets your mom do whatever. Like, that's not the relationship everyone has.
And then the other person, based on what you just said, that we not gonna let off the hook, and we gonna talk about this quite a bit, is Bertha Russell. You out here so heavy planning your event, and they knew, Aurora Faye knew your blind spot. You having your event, you're gonna prioritize your winning in your pursuit over your child, so I'm gonna throw the party the same day as her. And she's no way she's gonna come. That way she'll be alone. You so worried about this opera battle that your child is out here. This is, you had one job.
One job.
One job in this situation. And you are like out here with your daughter just like blowing in the wind at in the hands of Aurora Fane and Oscar Van Rijn. Like, what is happening?
And the wildest thing is when like her husband says, send her with Miss Brooke. I'm like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
At first I thought that they meant Ida, whose name is also Brooke.
Yeah.
But no, it's clear that they mean Marion. I'm like, I'm sorry, you're sending your like 18-year-old to be chaperoned by a 21-year-old? Like, what are you talking about? Yeah, like, the whole thing is weird.
It's wild, but what it does indicate, though, even though it's a little wild, is that George Russell thinks highly of Marion Brooke. Like, since last season, there's something that happened in those interactions and the way that she was able to help him, like, not lose in that situation he had in the courts and everything else. That has been, and I think, you know, he thinks highly of her. For sure.
I mean, I think all the Russells think pretty highly of Marion. She's always included. Obviously her and Larry have a budding friendship there. Her and Gladys get along well. Like, I think, yeah, for sure. I totally agree.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, we did talk a lot about Peggy. Is there anything else we want to talk about her story?
Well, I don't want to go off of Oscar for a moment I just want to address this thing that, you know, I think for people who didn't watch Downton Abbey, this is not going to be a big deal. But for me, who is a huge Downton fan, I'm still concerned. And I said this when we covered the show before. I'm really concerned about how Julian Fellowes imagines his queer characters. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why Oscar, first of all, has to be violently accosted in this first episode. And in addition to that, why he is... I wouldn't call him the villain of this season. He was more kind of like antagonistic last season, but we're joking around about how messy he is, but he is also like very careless about the harm that he can do to other people in playing this game that he's playing, where he is looking for this, a wealthy girl to kind of like, you know, he does have the response. He has the responsibility of carrying on his family name and managing everything, but it's not like they have a big estate. Yeah. You know, like it's not like these people, he's living large, right? Like, his mother lives fairly large, but he doesn't really.
Yeah.
And so I really don't like the way that Julian Fellowes writes these characters, his queer characters, as if they need a redemption arc. They don't need a redemption arc. You can write queer characters who are not going to be the victim of violence. You can write queer characters who have some joy in their life, which is a thing that was always a thing problem with Thomas in Downton Abbey, is that his life was just like joyless. Mm-hmm. And you can write them that they shouldn't always be kind of menacing. Like, I think Oscar is written as a lovable character. Obviously, Aurora and Marion and his mother and Ida all love him. So it's not the same problem as Thomas, but it's not much better. Like, this is, I'm very disappointed with the fact that he was beaten up in the first episode. And then immediately upon recovering is like, let me go manipulate this child into marrying me.
Yeah. And I don't understand the setup of the attack. Even it's like, guy buys you a drink at a bar. Like, and then, you know, it didn't make sense. How this was set up, even, it just felt like such a stretch. It felt like he needed to, it almost felt like, I need to make this happen, this is how I'm gonna do it, and it felt forced. It didn't, I agree with you 100% everything you said. So we've held out hope that it would improve, but this is not a great start to that.
No, you know what I mean? It's not a great start. I mean, we'll see, but like, I thought that Oscar was kind of becoming more of the family unit and would have more moments of like levity. And obviously him and Marion have really bonded, and they're cousins. So that makes sense. But I didn't love that he like suffered a trauma and then immediately went to manipulate this young woman. it was not, it's not a good look for him.
Agreed. I totally agree. So, Peggy, did we carry everything with Peggy? Because I think
we talked about the problems we had with Peggy, but I don't think we talked about the positive things.
Well, I just love that there's like, it seems like they're setting up a very clear storyline for not only Peggy, but for her parents. And you know, it's interesting that it starts at the whole season starts on Easter Sunday. You know, that famous quote about, like, you know, the most segregated time in America is, you know, 11 a.m. on Sunday. And it was interesting to see, like, two very different church services
mm-hmm.
happening. And it was, but it also sets the tone, in my opinion, for the fact that we may get a, what we asked for last time we covered the show was we really wanted to see a more fleshed out version of the Black families, characters, and community, and this setup here of like seeing other characters introduced, is hopeful. You know what I mean? It's hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. yeah, I really like the work they did with her parents in this first episode. Mm-hmm. This her mother, who I found kind of frustrating last season because she went along with the stuff that her father said and did even when she didn't agree.
Mm-hmm.
Those days are over.
Mm-hmm.
She's very angry at him, and understandably so. And I think that the story that she told about that light, that the first time that they met, in the life that Peggy doesn't really know, which is like they have lived in a different America than Peggy has experienced. A place where you being menaced by two white men who she said he saved my life. It's not like she's saying here that he just intervened when these two white men were bothering her. She's mm-hmm. she's telling her daughter a real story here about how you know, these two white men probably would have done something so horrible to her that she may not have lived. And I think that was really beautiful. Like I like that they're giving more to this family to do. Peggy's story is not just like a struggle story. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of triumph in it. And I like what they've done with Peggy. I remember I was really skeptical about this show when I saw there was a Black character. I was
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
not sure about this. But I think so far, with this one little misstep about how her son, the plot line of her son was handled, so far so good.
Yeah, I like it. I really, really do. So we have a lot of things going on in this story, and we're New Yorkers, and so we're going to talk about New York. But even us as New Yorkers, we get to do something with this show that we're doing during with the watch, after the watches. Like, it's so great. We Googled it for you. We Googled what is going on in this situation, okay?
The mark of a great period piece, and anyone who watches The Crown, y'all know this, is that while you're watching the show, you got your phone on deck to be like, wait, did this really happen?
Exactly. Always. You're like, did this really happen? Is that what, are they exaggerating this? So a couple of things we want to talk about. Let's kick it off. You want to talk about the Knights of Labor and that whole situation?
Yeah. So this is kind of just a passing comment from Mr. Russell, but the Knights of Labor is this group that is organizing workers all over the country. It was founded in 1869 by Uriah Stevens in Philadelphia. Initially, it was a secret society because organizing labor wasn't something that, you know, the bosses would have wanted to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it later became more open. And by 1879, the organization had rapid growth. Like, they had hundreds of thousands of members across several chapters all over the country. They advocated for workers' rights, most notably the 8-hour workday. I think we're going to talk a lot about that this season. Mm-hmm. And they achieved a lot of successes over the time that they were working. However, in the 1880s, a lot of internal conflicts came up, and they had so much opposition that they kind of they started to kind of fall off, and the AFL, which is a union that's still very powerful, kind of took their place. They did play like a really pivotal role in raising awareness for workers' rights and for other like social and economic reforms. But one of the most important things is that pretty early in their life, they allowed women and black people into their organization, which was like not a thing. Like if you know anything about the suffrage movement or labor movements in Europe, like they were very patriarchal. They were very white. And so at first, the Knights of Labor allowed women to join and black people because they knew that that would swell their numbers. Mm-hmm. However, no organization is without problems, and they have a really dark history, especially around Asian American workers. One of their chapters, and some of this is a little disputed. So there are folks who are going to take issue with this, but I just want to say I'm going with what is the prevailing narrative that came out of this. So one of their chapters was involved in a violent expulsion of Chinese workers in Tacoma, Washington. And in addition to that, members of the organization were also involved in what is called the Rock Springs Massacre in Springwater, Wyoming, where 28 Chinese laborers were murdered after Union Pacific Coal brought them in to break the strike. They also advocated for all kinds of legislation to limit Chinese workers' ability to get employment and to limit immigration in the United States from China and other Asian countries. So this is an organization that contributed to the what we think of as the modern labor movement, but they also mirrored a lot of prejudices that society had during those times, and you still see that in labor. Mm-hmm. You often see in labor discourse that there is a tension between American workers and immigrants, and that there's a tension between different types of labor get more attention than others. So mm-hmm. just to give an example, AFL, which is a labor union that I think most people know very well, you know, they organize factory workers, steel workers, you know, like the sort of that that group of people who work and make things. They make American products, right? Mm-hmm. SEIU, which is the Service Employees International Union, which is also a very large union in America, is never quite as influential. And I think I take that to be in large part because SEIU is made up of many women, mm-hmm. Many people who are immigrants, and because it's service work. Mm-hmm. And so this is just the beginning of the labor movement, but you can kind of see those things already fermenting. And I think that I hope that like that will come up this season, because it wasn't all smooth sailing, like rah, rah, go American worker. There were a lot of tensions within the labor union about who should even be included.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely hope they cover that. And what a great recap. And, you know, and it's so appropriate to be talking about this when you're seeing like all the strikes that are going on now, you know, the strikes, you know, that we have with the writers, the strikes that, you know, the SAG strike, the auto workers strike, the nurses that are striking because of many, you know, so we got an 8-hour work week, and there's still a lot of issues that are out there. Not everybody has an 8-hour work week. Let's keep it 100. Like some industries got a traditional 8-hour work week. There's some people who are still working 12-hour shifts. You know what I mean? Like especially nurses work pretty regularly, work 10, 12-hour shifts.
And what is the 8-hour workday worth if you are not allowed to leave your post until you're relieved? You know, like there's it's more complicated than just having clocking out at 5 o'clock and going home. But we'll talk more about that as the season goes on, because the 8-hour work week, 8-hour work day, is almost like a character. Yeah. Like, and,
oh man, I can't wait. I can't wait to take unpack that a little bit more. And I want to talk about the Academy of Music, because I have a lot to say about it. The Academy of Music, first of all, was a renowned opera house on the northeast corner of 14th Street and Irving Plaza in New York City.
And it's so funny what's there now.
I know. Just mark that. Mark that right now, because it used to be a place called the after that, there was a place called the Palladium. All right, the Palladium nightclub was over there. I've been to that place. I was like, whoa, that was the same place as the Academy of Music? Crazy. But around there also now is a dormitory, kind of wild. Is NYU bought it. But also, in that general area, so you guys could get a picture if you're not from New York, you know, you may have heard about this little thing called the L Project, you know, where there was like the L train was going to get shut down. And then Governor Cuomo was like, nah, son, we're keeping it running. And then when de Blasio was running for president, everybody was like, you know, like, what the hell is this guy doing? He couldn't fix the L train. At least I screamed that at the television multiple times. This is the area, one of the stops where the L train goes, Union Square. Many, many dates happen at a place called Max Brenner, which is close nearby there.
Oh my gosh, right? I forgot about Max Brenner. Yeah.
Max Brenner is in that general vicinity. Whole Foods, Best Buy is right around those dormitories. Irving Plaza, like for all my hip hop heads out there, you know where the famous shooting happened at Irving Plaza? That also happened in that general area. But one of the more famous current events that has happened, Twitch streamer, video gamer Kai Kinet was charged recently with inciting a riot in that general, right around that same block where the Academy of Music is in the Gilded Age. As you're watching this, this is how we've evolved. We've had, you know, L trains, date nights, social media induced riots. it's, you know, this is where we are. But in the time of the Gilded Age, it was also still at that point was an important cultural institution in the mid 19th century. Its doors first opened in 1854, and from then on, it became a beacon of elegance and refinement in the city. The opulence of the Academy's interior, with its ornate chandeliers, gilded moldings, and plush seating, made it a premier destination for the city's high society, which we, I'm sure, are going to see more of. The Academy of Music was also known for hosting a diverse array of performances, including grand operas, ballets, concerts, theatrical productions. It was one of the venues of choice for the elite of New York when they wanted to attend any of the galas that they threw, some opera premieres, and a lot of the other artistic events. Throughout the 19th century, the Opera House played a pivotal role in introducing iconic operatic works to the American audiences and featured acclaimed performers of the time, which is why Mrs. Astor is appalled that the same performer that's supposed to open the Met is scheduled to perform at the Academy of Music. She's like, wait a minute, we're supposed to be bringing premier people and the Met is supposed to be an inferior thing, but they've already surpassed.
They already got Christine Nilsson. Exactly. So
pretty cool. And not only that, Bertha Russell can just pay her to come and sing in her living room.
So I know. I mean, let's talk about that was a real flex, right? Like, not only is she going to come and open the Met, but like she's here right now.
Exactly.
She's here.
Exactly. Super great. What a first episode. Oh my God. I loved it. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I'm excited for this season. And I'm excited we're covering the whole season.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad we can give this show the attention that I believe it deserves. Because this was kind of like a breakout hit. Like, yeah. It went from being a show that like mostly the people who like Downton Abbey were talking about to being a show that was almost like, you know, must see Monday night TV, and it must have performed well enough that they've moved it to Sunday.
100%.
I'm hyped about, because, man, it is real hard to watch anything at the start of the work week. Like, I'm always, my Monday shows always wait till like Friday for viewing. So I'm really glad this one's on Sunday.
And it's really cool because, like, you know, after a whole day of football and shenanigans, here's the Gilded Age. You can just settle right in and disconnect from the football shenanigans of the day.
Before we wrap up, I did want to just ask you, because I was thinking about this last night, and I don't think we've had a chance to talk about this. Why do you what do you think makes this show different from Bridgerton? These are both big hits, right? Mm-hmm. And there's other period pieces that kind of don't break through as well as these two. I'm thinking, like, Masterpiece is just constantly churning out period pieces, and some of them do very well, but not like everybody knows what you're talking about when you bring them up well. Bridgerton and Gilded Age seem to have broken through that. It's not just a show for people who enjoy period pieces. And they're very different. And what do you think, like, aside from the budget, because it's obvious that Gilded Age has a bigger budget. Like, you can just tell from looking at it. But, like, what do you think kind of sets it apart from Bridgerton?
I have a lot of thoughts about this. This is a good one that you're asking. I'm so glad you asked it too. For me personally, I think what I love about this particular show, just personally, is the historical references to the place where I grew up, obviously. Mm-hmm. But also, I think, you know, going meta a little bit, like, I kind of know some of the places where they're shooting it. So as a person, me personally, I get, like, just a personal watcher, I get, like, excited to be like, oh, wow, I know that that's, you know, I don't know, like, you know, Saratoga Springs, or, like, I have a friend who was an extra in it, because, you know, that kind of stuff. So that kind of stuff, like, gets me excited about the show. But I think for the beyond me, my own feeling about it, like, just, like, what I think my perspective on, like, why people think it's a little different is, I think it's because it's an American period piece where Bridgerton and Downton both happen in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's interesting about society in America is there was also the idea introduced into society of the possibility of entering society from not being part of society at all based on your financial status. And that's the main tug pull that I think is different in these period pieces, is that, like, you know, there's a real chance that somebody from downstairs could become a member of high society with two or three or four or five moves. Now they're instead of being downstairs serving, they're sitting working. You're sitting enjoying the same things that the other people are. And that is the infusion of, like, the idea of the American dream into the period piece that I think is highly different. It adds to the drama. I also think stylistically, like you said, budget, all of that. And I think, like, it's an actual, between Bridgerton specifically and this show, in my opinion, Shonda Rhimes, brilliant writer, Julian Fellowes, brilliant writer. I love them both and for different reasons. But I think it's actually a good comparison because it's like new money, old money. I think Julian Fellowes is so steeped in costume dramas from the very beginning. Like, he's done it for so long that it's like the old traditional, all the old traditions of the costume drama. Mm-hmm. With, like, new American sensibilities, that he's like, that's where the stretch is. Where Shonda Rhimes is a brilliant writer and is steeped in so many other traditional things, other kind of writing, that this is kind of her, that was, like, one of her first stabs at a costume drama, and it's brilliant how she's doing it, right? So to me, that is, it's like almost like she's like a newcomer to this whole thing, and it's only going to grow and evolve even more. Mm-hmm. So that's my feeling on it, is that the American piece of it, upper mobility being added to the costume drama, and just the difference in the traditions of who the two writers are and their writing teams. I would argue, though, that if you flipped, I don't know that Julian Fellowes, I'm saying this, I also want to make it very clear, I don't know that Julian Fellowes and his team could write the other things, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder, that Shonda Rhimes writes. So she's actually shown her ability to enter this world in a way that's going to, like, only expand in time.
Yeah, I think I think also that Bridgerton is working with source material for the most part, except for with Queen Charlotte, which Shonda wrote herself. But I think they're both really different, and Bridgerton just feels infinitely more modern. Mm-hmm. But the stakes are also really different in both of them. Yeah. I don't think in Bridgerton we've ever had a point where it's been like, you know, somebody could lose all of their money. Mm-hmm. They could lose their social standing, right? But like, I think there's just something about the setting of the story where it's New York, where that way, that rising up out of maybe being in part of the underclass and becoming part of the upper class, it works both ways.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't see that as much in the UK based period pieces. You might see people marry for money. You might even see people's status reduced, right? Like, mm-hmm. one of the best period pieces of all time is Sense and Sensibility. And the whole, like, the whole premise of it is that this family, the Dashwood family, lived really well. And then the father died. Mm-hmm. And all his money went to his son from his previous marriage. And so their status is reduced immediately. So that happens, right? Mm-hmm. But it just, they feel so different to me, but they're both really good and enjoyable. I'm also looking forward to season 3 of Bridgerton, which I mm-hmm. think got pushed back because of the various strikes until next year. Mm-hmm. They're like dancing to the same music, but they have different moves.
Yeah. You know? And I think we're going to revisit this theme a little bit too. So I'm looking forward. I would really love to compare these more, like maybe even in a wrap up, like to get further down, because I think there are some real crossovers that are things that are comparable. You know what I mean? And I really, and one of the things I was thinking about when you were saying what you were saying is the other thing is like I think Bridgerton is most seasons are based around a love story, and we know that there's love stories present in you know Gilded Age. But
it's not focused on the marriage plot.
Yeah,
it's not there. That's a really good observation. Whether Marion gets married or not, do we really care?
No, exactly. 100%.
If Gladys never gets married, do we really care? Like it's like almost a, because it's more focused on the older generation who already have been married or are currently married, like that piece of it, that younger generation, will they, won't they, is there, right? Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Since last season, I'm like, listen, Marianne, just walk across the street.
Yeah.
Larry's right there.
Agreed.
Especially
after the last party, like I was like, oh, this is good. And he walks her across the street. I'm like,
right?
I'm like,
right?
Okay, let's go.
Let's get it popping.
Yeah.
Let's. You guys could be like the new money, old money marriage, like for peace. Like, exactly. Let's get it popping.
Exactly.
But it's not the main feature of the show. Like, I actually don't care about the love lives of the younger generation, Peggy, Marion, or Gladys, or Larry. I kind of care about Oscars because for different reasons, right? But it's not the same kind of like we're focused on will they, won't they love story. So,
yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, Agnes is like ready to marry off Marion as soon as she can. Like she's ready.
Yeah, because Agnes is, did you notice that Marion's cost, like her dresses have gotten, she had a little wardrobe glow up.
Yeah, she tried.
Yeah, Agnes is trying to get that dress allowance off of her books. That's why she pinching pennies. She's like, listen, this girl eats X amount a week. Plus, she, you know, I can't have my niece looking out in these streets looking raggedy. Plus, I got to give her money, for clothes. And so she ain't about that life. She's trying to get that.
Said, you ain't gonna have me out here like Mrs. Featherington. It ain't gonna happen. You ain't gonna have me out here like this. Oh man. All right, well that'll do it. We are so excited to be covering the Gilded Age. Hit us up at kinfolklore@gmail.com. And we look forward to communicating with you guys and talking all things Gilded Age. And until next time.
Bye everyone.